Hey folks, Randy Newberg here with the Hunt Talk Podcast, Hunt Talk Radio, as some of you know it as Randy Newberg Unfiltered. I'm in Bozeman, Montana today with my buddy Dan Doty, who is, as you've come to learn, the producer of this operation. He works for 0.0. And we were going through all the questions that you have been sending us out on the Hunt Talk forum. And it's not new to those of us out on the Hunt Talk or those of us in the West, but a lot of these questions focus around public lands. And to get even deeper into what the crux of it is, across the West, there's a resurgence of this idea that is an old idea, but what it is that somehow if the state trust departments of the West took over these lands from the BLM and from the Forest Service, somehow it would save all that ails us. And Dan's over there nodding his head like, really? Huh. So anyhow, we've looked at a lot of these questions you guys gave us, and Dan and I are going to kind of have our own little back and forth Q&A session. And the reason we're doing a full podcast, and who knows, it might grow into a second podcast on this topic, is in the summer of 2015, as I'm sitting here right now, there is no issue more important to hunters, whether you live in the West and hunt the West or you live somewhere else and hunt the West. There is no issue more important than that, preserving access to these public lands. So I'm going to give you the history. I'm going to kind of use Dan as my student here to ask questions and not let me skip over the details, because one thing that's been pointed out to me, Dan, is, Randy, you go too fast sometimes. You're taking advantage, or you're assuming.
Yeah, I'll keep you on point and make sure you're answering all the questions. And this, I mean, it's legit too, as being a student here. I've been learning about this stuff from Randy over the past year or so, maybe a little longer. And it's a very complex and fascinating subject and important. So it's pretty legit.
Yeah,
curiosity.
And the fact that it's so complicated is what gives the other side the easy 2-second soundbite. You think about it, it's usually pitched as, oh, those damn feds, they can't manage their land. Well, really, who are the feds? The feds is Congress. So if we got problems with how our state land or our federal lands are managed, it's Congress's problem. They're the ones who say, oh, we can't charge the going rate for oil and gas royalties. We can't charge the going rate for grazing leases. We're not going to charge the going rate for coal leases. But then those same guys in Congress who want to snivel about how public lands on the federal level are managed, when you pass a bill to say, hey, let's manage these a little bit more like the states do and increase these fees and make sure we're getting fair market value, who are the guys screaming and yelling? The same people who complain that the federal lands aren't managed well. So, you know, in today's modern world, it seems like we've done a really good job of making the feds the enemy all the time. And if it comes to hunting issues, I guess half the time it's the state's problem. It's, you know, I think we as people have a tendency to blame somebody. But when you get into this whole idea, I want to try and lay it out from the beginning that gives people the ability to understand what's at play here and how the nuances and differences of what's being proposed are detrimental to hunters compared to what we enjoy today. And
why don't you just lay out the absolute simplest, the simple story for everybody right now?
Sure.
Just so if somebody's tuned in doesn't really know this,
yep.
What is happening? What do they want to happen?
Yep.
Just the basics.
Okay. And I'm going to preface this by saying, look, I grew up in a logging family. So I'm not here to hold up federal land management and all the litigation around federal land management as the textbook model of what we should do. But when I get done with all this, I think most hunters are going to look at it and say, well, the feds aren't perfect, that's for sure. But what's being proposed and sold to me here is even worse. So to really understand this discussion, you need to understand that back when all of the Western states were granted statehood to the Union, mostly I think Nevada was in the Civil War in the 1860s, and then most of the other Western states kind of around that same period, even later for quite a few of them. What happened is the the U.S. government said, you know what, we're going to help you fund your school systems by giving you these pieces of land. And in those of you who understand surveying or look at maps, you know that a township is 6 miles square. In other words, 6 wide by 6 north to south. And in each of those is a section. When people out west talk about a section of land, they're talking about 640 acres, 1 square mile. So a township is 6 by 6 or 36 square miles. And the federal government said that in some instances, we're going to give you, in every township, we're going to give you section 16 and 36. And in some of the granting of the lands to these states, they gave them a third or fourth section in every township. The whole idea being that the states will hold these lands in trust, not for the citizens themselves, but for funding of the school systems. So just that in its very nature, if you go to the New Mexico State Land Office, it says this very clear. Note, state trust lands are not public lands. And everyone's of the impression that these state departments that everyone's saying we should transfer these lands to, that supposedly these are public lands.
Can you state that just so it's like, I really mean it, like that people right now want to transfer federal lands to state trust land. Just
exactly.
Like to establish that for all the viewers.
Okay. So thanks for backing me up here. So what's being proposed by these groups, they call them transfer advocates, is let's take the BLM lands that are federal and let's take the Forest Service lands that are federal and let's hand them over to these state trust departments. All these Western states have these trust lands. Like in Montana, we call it the Department of Natural Resources and Conservation. There's a lot of different state agencies, but they're all trust departments to manage lands on behalf of their school systems. So that's how a lot of the Western states fund their school systems. It's why a lot of times you'll talk to someone in New York and their property taxes are $12,000 a year, and you talk to me in Montana and my property taxes are $2,000 a year. Because in New York, that's how they're paying their property taxes, or funding their school system by paying higher property taxes. In the West, here in Montana, using that example, our schools are heavily funded by the management of these lands that we got at statehood. So, I don't know.
So literally they're taking the resources off that land and making money however they can.
Right. It could be timber, it could be grazing, mining, oil and gas is the huge one. With the big oil and gas boom of the last 10 years, that's been the big cash cow for these lands. And nobody's saying we should stop doing smart management. But you have to understand if a state trustee who manages these lands has one responsibility. The state constitution says you're accountable only to the funding of schools. You don't have to worry about access. You don't have to worry about clean water, clean air, wildlife, anything else. You got one job, and that's to raise money for the schools. So you compare that to BLM and Forest Service lands where, okay, we got to manage for diverse species, we have to manage for access, we have to manage for recreation, we have to manage for water quality, for air quality. All of a sudden, the things that our federal lands are managed for, those managers are accountable to to 325 million Americans, whereas the state trust land departments are not. So right there, and it's just by the very nature of how state trust land departments are set up, makes it way different than what we currently enjoy.
Just a quick, is there any, do they want to do this because schools need money, or is that just a complete aside? Because I would think that'd be a whole different issue.
Right. No. It's all under the premise of better management of the lands is what the kind of the smoke screen that's thrown out there. And to answer your question, you really almost have to go back to the late 1980s. And what they called the Sagebrush Rebellion. And at that time, the whole gist of this was, let's sell the public lands. There are a lot of people in this country who do not believe that there should be public lands. It's just their ideology. It's like they're a burden. They're, you know, the market should allocate everything, blah, blah, blah. And whether you agree with that or disagree with that, personally, we as a society have kind of rejected that notion by the fact that we've got, you know, I don't know how many hundred million of acres of public lands in this country. But the idea was being pushed back in the late 80s by the Sagebrush Rebellion. They got their teeth handed to them. I mean, it was a beat down of the
So they were trying to sell off the federal lands.
Right.
That's what they were trying to do.
Right. And their whole spin there was, well, we're the locals, we're the users of the land, sell them to us. And then they had their ideologues who said, yeah, let's just sell it to them. Well, that didn't fly very well.
And who was the they exactly? Who was
the they is, it's, you know, it's hard to put a they on them. It was mostly folks who used public lands at a very discounted level, who didn't want to be told what to do. It was county commissioners who thought that, okay, even though I moved here, or I was born here, or I decided to stay and live here, I want these public lands to be mine. I think me and my buddies should say what happens here. When really, these public lands belong to all Americans. So, and I tell this often to people and say, here's what's really being requested here. And it's an example I try to use that some people get it, some don't. So I'm going to use it here and hopefully it sinks in. But let's say that Uncle Bud dies and he leaves a trust full of assets. It's a, you know, $100 million portfolio of assets. And there are, I don't know, let's say 325 beneficiaries. I'll say that so that each beneficiary represents a million Americans. So we say, all right, Mr. Trustee, federal government, you are supposed to manage this big portfolio of income, of assets, to provide income for all 325 of these beneficiaries. And I come forward and say, you know what? A lot of these assets are based in Montana. So the Montana assets should all be mine because I'm the only one of the 325 who live in Montana, but I should get all the Montana assets. And the other beneficiaries say, wait a second, 20% of these assets are in Montana and you only represent one person. Why would we give them all to you? Well, in effect, if you think about how these federal lands, BLM and Forest Service, are held in trust for all Americans, but yet these politicians want to say, oh, let's just give the 30 million acres in Montana to the Montana schools or to those users in Montana, what does that do to the other, you know, 99.4% of Americans? It screws them out of their ownership of that land. Because we go back to the fact that as much as we'd like to think of state trust lands being public lands, they're really not public. You know, a lot of people say, well, in my state, I can hunt a wildlife management area. Yep, you can, because those are usually managed by state wildlife agencies, not state land departments. And some states have really good plans of managing their state forests. Where I grew up in northern Minnesota, state forests were managed pretty well. So there are some examples out there that say the states can do a good job of managing. But in the West, what we're talking about is transferring hundreds of millions of acres that currently are owned by all citizens of the United States and telling them, oh, you no longer are a beneficiary. Kind of like my example of me saying, you other 324 beneficiaries, I've convinced the trustee to give me all the Montana-based assets because I live here.
The benefits being access to use them, correct?
Right. If these were financial assets, you know, I get all the income off them. I get, you know, if I sell them, I get all the proceeds from a sale or whatever. I mean, if you think about, if you went to a group of 325 Congress people and said, oh, we're going to screw 324 of you out of your trust benefits, of whether it was a financial trust or whatever, those 324 would be screaming and yelling. But they have no problem supporting ideas and legislation that would screw Americans out of other assets that are their lands. So this is what, and it's such a complicated setup that we have that it's really hard to have this kind of discussion on a face-to-face basis with everybody who's affected by it. Because there's hundreds of millions of Americans who don't even realize that if these became state lands, I'd be screwed.
Well, yeah, it's kind of a hidden issue, I think, in the big picture. Is this getting much press?
It is. It's now starting to get a lot of press. And how it started, back to the history, you know, it was the Sagebrush Rebels who started it, and they got thumped. I mean, they got sized for some big ass hats over that one, and they ran in the corner and hid for about 20 years. And then in southern Utah, you start having this movement again about, we got to take over the federal lands. We got to take over the federal lands.
And so, recently you're talking?
Recently, yeah. Like in the last 10 years.
Okay.
And now they said, well, let's not use the word sale. Because when we say we want, you know, these lands should be for sale, that creates a lot of negatives with people. Let's call it transfer. Yeah, there we go. Let's call it transfer. And so they come up with the idea of, oh, the feds are this and the feds are that. And again, I'm not here to say the feds are perfect land managers, but they're using this crisis of federal land management as their way of trying to capitalize on the turmoil and give the two-second soundbite. Oh, yeah, just give it to the states. And I'll be honest, when I first heard the idea of state transfer, I thought, you know what, that might be a good idea. Maybe we'll break some of this gridlock. Maybe things won't be as bad. And then I started rolling back the layers.
Well, how are they bad? So, I mean, right. What is bad about the way
okay.
they're managed?
Okay, so I'm going to use a couple examples.
Okay,
I'm going to use Colorado because it's the easiest example to use. Colorado state trust lands, which is the majority of state lands in Colorado by a huge margin. I mean, like 90-some percent of their state lands are managed by the state trust department for their schools. Okay, we have 23 million acres, I think it is, of BLM and Forest Service lands in Colorado. Let's just walk through the scenario. If we transferred those 23 million acres of currently accessible public federal lands in Colorado and we gave them to the Colorado State Trust Land Department and said, here, you can have them. Do what you want. Operate the way you always have. Well, that's 23 million acres you couldn't hike on because in Colorado, you can't hike on state lands. State
At
trust
all.
Lands. None.
Really?
You can't camp on them. You can't hunt them. So as a hunter who hunts Colorado every year, I think, wow, that... How are we going to replace the hunting access just in one state of 23 million acres? Because now it becomes state trust land that the person who controls the hunting, the recreation, the camping, everything else is the person who's leasing those lands for grazing or whatever else they might lease it for. So if you're an American, this idea just in one state called Colorado says, oh, you want to come and hike and bag some of these 14,000-foot peaks in Colorado? Guess what? If this goes through, you aren't doing it. You can't cross those lands because they're no longer Forest Service. They're state trust lands. Colorado hosts more non-resident elk hunters and tons of non-resident deer hunters. Just about all of us go there and hunt the western two-thirds of the state because that's where all the Forest Service and BLM is. Guess what? Going to be pretty easy to draw a tag in Colorado because no one's going to have a place to hunt because we cannot hunt their state trust lands. Yes, we can hunt their state wildlife agency lands, but not their state trust lands. So that's probably the easiest example when someone asks, well, why isn't this good? I'll use another example of Wyoming. Okay, a lot of people go and hunt elk, deer, antelope in Wyoming. In Wyoming, you cannot camp on these state trust lands. So, all right, you just waited 5 years and you drew the best mule deer tag Wyoming has to offer in what we call Region G, and it's mostly the Wyoming range on the western side of the state. And the reason it's so good is it's just badass country. I mean, it, you got to be committed to get in there. And so the age class of mule deer is just tremendous. It's not just the best mule deer hunting in Wyoming. It's probably some of the best in all of the United States. So let's think about all that Forest Service land there all of a sudden became Wyoming State Trust land. What are you going to do with your Region G deep mule deer tag? All right. Let's see. It's a 7-hour hike to get in there. So
it's a big day hiking in and out.
Right. Yeah. You can't camp there. Wyoming, you cannot camp on state trust lands. So what are you going to do? You're going to hike in every day? You're going to rent a motel in Big Piney or LaBarge or Daniel Junction? You're going to drive your truck for an hour and then hike for 6 or 7 hours, get up there, look around, say, didn't see anything. I better turn around and get out of here because I got to be out of here by dark.
Unless you just drink a lot of coffee and don't go to sleep. I hunt all night long.
But the point is, anyone who bases their hunting or fishing as you know, your base camp is on BLM or Forest Service land, you're screwed. And New Mexico doesn't allow you to camp on state lands. I mean, there's so many of these western states have restrictions that people don't really think about as it affects those of us who right now, we take for granted that, oh, we have such great camping and hunting and fishing access on these federal BLM and Forest Service lands. We think that's going to stay intact if these lands transfer to the state. It's not.
So that's a big deal, I would think, right? If anybody who enjoys using these national forest lands or BLM lands, if all of a sudden you can't have access to them, it's going to be a big deal.
You would think so. And that's so how long have we been talking here before I was able to finally...
That's what I was going to say, about 22 minutes in. Yeah. And so, I mean, it is very obvious to anybody who's listening, it's super obvious that this is... not only a big issue, but it's something that Randy is, I mean, this is your issue. I mean, this is what's going on right now.
Yeah.
And
it's complicated.
There's so much you want to say on this.
Right.
I mean, it just pours out of you.
Does it?
But I think we should get and maybe lay it out a little more basically and simply again. I think we're kind of rushing into things, but why? I think start with a why. Why is this so important to you specifically?
And I'm glad you asked that, Dan, because that was what I was going to start with. And obviously my mind just jumps into the deep end of the pool here and I completely blew over that. And it's kind of why I started the On Your Own Adventures TV show, which has become Fresh Tracks with Randy Newberg, is all self-guided public land hunting. And everyone says, why public land? And it's not because I have any problem with private land. Man, I've hunted a lot of private land in my life, so don't get me wrong there. That's not it at all. But people who know me, and you've heard me talk about on this podcast growing up in this little town of 500 people in northern Minnesota called Big Falls. And when my parents were 11, they got divorced, and it was not a very pretty divorce. And my dad was kind of out of the picture for a little while, quite a while. And my mom was raising three kids. I was the oldest. She was trying to raise three kids being a waitress right at the time when I was at that age where I'm either going to become a hunter or I'm not. So I was lucky, and I didn't understand at the time how important public lands were to me and all the people nearby who had public lands right out our back door. And I tell people, if hunting would have cost a dollar a day, these public lands were free to me. But even if it cost as small as a dollar a day to have hunting access, Randy Newberg wouldn't be a hunter. I wouldn't have, my mom could not have afforded it. I mean, it was, I don't want to sound like the old Depression days, but no one in our town grew up on the right side of the tracks. We were all on the wrong side of the tracks, and it was just tough. And so
it was Chippewa National Forest, is that right?
We were near Chippewa National Forest. We're near Superior National Forest. Right out my back door, though, pretty much was Pine Island State Forest.
Oh.
And if you go the other way, it was Kuchiching State Forest.
Okay.
And so we had millions of acres at our disposal that if we could hitchhike or sometimes ride our bike, and even out my back door, there was a trail that followed the river, I could get to the forest. And I took that for granted growing up, and all of my buddies did. And then I moved to places where it wasn't like that. that there was a lot of private land, mm-hmm. and how getting access either meant you had a family relationship, you had a business relationship, or you wrote a check for a trespass fee, or you went on an outfitted hunt. And the odds of me growing up having any of the four of those options, you know, family who owned land, none of us did. You know, I didn't have a business where I could get invited by some client to go hunting. And I certainly couldn't have afforded to pay a trespass fee. And my mom couldn't afford to send me on a guided hunt. So without these public lands, what would Randy Newberg's passion in life be right now? I don't know.
Be a football coach.
Maybe. I don't know what it would be, Dan. But it. So when I left there and I moved out west, I became a CPA and worked for a large national CPA firm and had some opportunities available to me that personally would have been very lucrative financially. My wife had a way better job than I did, and we were, you know, life looked grand. But I was looking for a place where I could go and live in a community, live in a place that was back to that connection to the public lands. And so I moved to Bozeman, Montana in 1991. And since I've moved here, you could pretty much ask any politician in Montana that if you want to piss Randy off and you want your life to be miserable, screw with the public lands. And so that's why I built these TV shows around it. It's why this podcast is going to be so heavily involved and engaged in public land issues. It's why the Hunt Talk Forum has so many topics related to public land access. And at the risk of sounding overly dramatic, my generation, I'm 50. If we screw up this public land legacy, we have screwed up so big. There's just nothing else I can see that is going to affect hunting and affect the community I come from, not the geographic community, but the community of hunters I come from and that I hope I try to give some voice to. Nothing is going to negatively impact them more than the loss of these public lands and access to them.
Is there also a big tie directly to conservation of species? I imagine that's a big connection as well.
It's
right?
A huge part of it. I mean, you look at the conservation work that happens on these large landscapes. And I'm going to use Montana, for example. And we've got some great private land stewards in Montana. I mean, our state's two-thirds public, two-thirds private, one-third public. But grizzly bears never disappeared from Montana. Wolverines never disappeared from Montana. Lynx, wolves, none of them ever officially disappeared from here. And we have elk. Every native species that was here when Lewis and Clark came is still here. Huh. And a lot of the conservation work that has allowed those species to start creeping back up to some level of abundance, even the ones we hunt, elk and mule deer and antelope and bighorn sheep, most of that conservation has happened on public lands. And now it's spread more and more back to private lands, who they make a great contribution to the cause also. But I look at the conservation issue, I look at the public access issue, and hunting is so dependent upon both of those. And you know me, you've seen me, you've filmed me before. You know that when it comes to hunting, Randy's not going to sit down and stand in line.
Yeah.
No. You know, if I think it needs to be said, I'm going to say it. And I don't care which politician I piss off. I don't care if they're left, right, RD, in the middle, up, or down.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm equal opportunity. You're either with the hunting and fishing community or you're not. And it's that simple. So that kind of gets to the why is this so important to me. And I know some people listening might be like, oh, Randy, that's, you know, sounds like grandpa back in the Depression. It was uphill to school both ways, you know. But and I don't mean it to be that way, but it is just that important to the future. And you think about the National Shooting Sports Foundation did their study in 2009, and they said they gave all of these reasons, potential reasons for why people either quit hunting, they don't get into hunting, or they hunt less than they used to. So for those three answers, the number one reason given was loss of accessible lands to hunt. So if you are supporting hunting and you say, I'm a fan for the future of hunting, how can you be a fan for the future of hunting and not also be a huge advocate for public lands? Because the studies show that without lands to hunt, hunting has a pretty dark future. And so that it's, for me, it's really easy to connect those dots. I don't know if I'm making sense here with all this.
I think you're making a lot of sense. But so let's go back and start from the very, very, very beginning, the history part. And so when did these lands originally get designated as public lands? What's the history behind that a little bit?
Okay, let's use, again, the Northern Rockies. Yeah. So where we're sitting here in Montana used to be part of French territory. You know, Thomas Jefferson bought it from the French, called the Louisiana Purchase, and he sent Lewis and Clark up here. And at that time, it was all federal United States-owned land. And so Lewis and Clark come and say, oh, there's an abundance like the mind cannot imagine. And pretty soon we have people pushing west to settle and pioneer. And over the course of time, you know, homesteading acts and all that. So a lot of the really good lands, the most productive lands, were staked out by homesteaders, which I don't blame them. I mean, there's places, you know, that you just couldn't make a living. So they had to be pretty selective in where they staked that out. So when each territory got a high enough population, they could say, hey, we want to be admitted to the Union. So at the time each state got admitted to the Union, they have what's called an Enabling Act. And that's the legislation that passes Congress to say, yes, we're going to admit Montana or Wyoming or Idaho or whoever. We're going to admit you as one of the states of the Union. In that Enabling Act, all of that language talks about this kind of stuff. Most of the Western states' Enabling Acts say that we hereby forego any future claim to the lands retained by the United States of America. So there's this argument out there that says, oh, these should have been handed to the states at the time. No, the Enabling Act that all of our territorial legislators agreed to said, guess what? The federal government's going to have a presence of these lands within your boundaries.
Gotcha.
But, oh, to help you fund your schools, we're going to grant you 2 or 3 or 4 sections out of every 36 sections to fund your schools.
So there were national forests, that kind of public federal land, even before there were national parks.
Right.
Is that true?
Right. Theodore Roosevelt kind of brought all that out when he was president.
Gotcha.
He started what was called the Forest Reserve System, which we now call the National Forests, the U.S. Forest Service. And at pretty much the same point in time when he was instilling this conservation ethic in America, he was the one out officially designating lands for control and management by the Forest Service. They were federal lands at the time.
Gotcha.
They were always federal lands. He just said, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to designate this boundary as Gallatin National Forest and this boundary as Superior National Forest and this one as, you know, whatever it might be, the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest.
Gotcha. So you're saying from the very beginning when the states became states,
these lands were federal
and there was also designated state trust lands that were there from the very beginning.
Time began. So this is not like something new. So there's this constitutional fiction that's being promoted by these groups that want to sell the public lands that, oh, we states, we had a gun at our head when we signed our statehood enabling acts and blah, 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 and you screwed us over. Oh, really? If you feel that way, why don't you go get lawyered up and take it to the courts? And they don't, because every time they start going to the courts, they get their ass handed to them. So now their new mechanism, after getting beat up with the Sagebrush Rebellion call or rallying cry of sell the public lands, now this, in the last few years, they've went to all of the Western state legislatures and said, you guys need to sue the federal government to give you back these lands.
Hold on. I just want to, just to stop you and slow down just for one second,
sure.
Just to make it super clear, there are a group of folks,
right,
that for political or ideological reasons,
yep,
in the West who, yep, believe that these federal lands, which are national forests and BLM land,
yep,
are no good. It shouldn't be there, and they want them to no longer be federally controlled and to be at one point sold and now transferred to state trust oversight.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. I just want to put in case anybody's not.
These groups, whether it's political or personal ideologies, have said, well, if you won't sell them outright, federal government, we're going to try and lobby and coerce and cajole the idea that you should at least transfer them to the states. And the reason being, if you look at the Western states, they have a tremendous track record of selling lands. I mean, so if you can't get the feds to sell the lands, give the lands to the state and let them sell them.
I see.
Every state in the West right now has a state lands department that if you go to their website, you can see the piece that they're the link on there that says, if you want to nominate some of our lands for sale, click here. And here's our staff people who sell lands.
Hmm.
So this isn't like they would have to dream this up. I mean, just last week, Utah sold 3,000 acres at auction of some of their prettiest lands. I don't know why. But you can't hunt them anymore, or you're not going to be able to as quick as this auction transfer happens. You know, they raised a couple million bucks, I think. And so that money will go in the state school system for Utah. And now we don't have access to them.
Right.
That's a perfect model of what's been there. And it's not just today. It's a history of this happening.
So with that history in mind, that right now transferring lands to the states is just a backdoor way to eventually sell them.
Right. If you want to connect two dots, Dan, that's really what it is. But they like to put up enough smoke in the middle that hopefully no one's going to see through it, because we're now over a half hour into this discussion, and it takes a lot of parting of the fog here.
Do they have a website? I'm just curious.
Yeah, there's a group called ALC, American Lands Council, in Utah. That's their whole premise. But if you go out to that website, it's not going to talk about proper land management. It's not going to talk about public access. It's going to talk about the constitutional issues that their ideologues, how they interpret the Constitution, even though the courts have thumped them every time they've went there.
Hmm.
So
interesting.
And here's the irony.
You know what their first landing page says is, why are thousands of roads and trails being closed?
Exactly. Yeah. So they're using those kind of pitches. Well, the reason thousands of roads and trails are being closed is, one, it might be for wildlife purposes. It might be for erosion. Or it might not be any of that. It might just be that the feds have been starved by Congress that they don't have the money to maintain roads. Which, that implies that somehow the states have the money to maintain these roads.
Oh,
if you've ever come out west and you've been on state lands, you will see that states don't have the budget for roads. They don't have the budget for noxious weeds and invasive weed species. They don't have the money for fire suppression. I mean, if Montana had a really bad fire season, or Arizona, or whoever it might be, a $500 million fire bill to protect all the structures in a big fire or a couple big fires,
yeah,
Montana would be almost bankrupt. And so this website and these promoters of it, they don't want to talk about that stuff.
It's really interesting. I guess I should have looked at this website before, but it's almost it's taken me aback a little bit, because what they are sort of promoting here are really... I mean, they're saying we want access and we want public lands to be healthy. Or, I'm sorry, not public lands. We want our lands to be healthy and there to be access and productive. It's interesting. I think you mentioned earlier that when you first, if somebody had said you thought it was a good idea, if I came across this website all on my own with no knowledge, I'd be like, well, yeah, these guys are maybe on something.
Exactly. I mean, they've got the easy sales pitch. You can just make it that simple. But everyone, not everyone, but if you haven't spent a lot of time looking at the differences between state trust land rules and federal BLM Forest Service rules, you wouldn't make that connection. If you didn't know the history of how these states have sold most of their land, some of them, you wouldn't understand that this motivation here is really to sell these lands and get it in private hands.
Right.
I mean, I went to college in Reno, So as part of going to school in Nevada, you got to take a year of Nevada history. And at the time, it was kind of interesting, cool. One thing we studied was the history of land activities in Nevada. They call the state motto as Battle Born because they were brought into the Union during the Civil War, kind of rushed into that because the Union wanted more non-slave states. So Nevada came, even though they maybe not met all the criteria. Well, at the time, they were awarded over 3 million acres for their state school system. And they looked around and said, you know, Nevada's a pretty dry spot. We would give you back these 3 million if you'd let us go and handpick the best 2.1 million. And Congress made that deal. I think it was like in the 1880s. So Nevada ends up with not 3 million of just random every, you know, section 16 or 36, but you go out and handpick what you think is best because it's a dry, arid place. So they did. Guess how much of that 2.1 million acres of land that Nevada had in their state trust department, guess how much they have today?
No idea.
Close to zero.
Huh.
Almost none. I mean, I've heard varying reports that the state trust land department in Nevada, and I've looked and tried to find it. I can't find any number where they have more than 30,000 acres. Most of the reported numbers are of the 2.1 million. They still have 3,500 acres of it.
Wow. So they just sold it and then just put the money aside for schools.
Put the money aside.
They just sold it.
And they didn't even put it all aside for schools.
Oh.
I mean, they... If you go to the Las Vegas Strip, that land was sold in a lot of instances for $1.25 per acre.
Huh.
Yeah, because it was state trust land. And who did all the buying? The legislators. It's some of the most, if you want to read a story about corruption, go read the story about how Nevada liquidated its state lands that it received from the federal government. It's one of the most interesting stories you could read. And if that doesn't cause you to worry about what would happen to these lands if the BLM and federal Forest Service lands became state trust lands, then you have a different level of concern than I do.
Right.
It's just how it is. I mean, Wyoming, if you go to their state trust land website, it says, we manage the 3.5 million remaining acres of the 4.2 million we were granted at statehood. Well, 3.5 million is a lot, but flip that around. They've sold 700,000 acres.
Wow.
That's a lot of hunting access. That's a lot of camping access, fishing access. And now we don't have access to any of that. Utah has sold millions and millions of acres. So my point is I want hunters to think about this in the context of what does it mean to me?
Yeah.
As much as I might be pissed off at the feds for A, B, C, H, J, K, think about this idea and what it really means for you.
And spell it out. What does it mean?
It means that in a lot of places, your hunting access is going to completely disappear in a state like Colorado. It means that in states like Wyoming and New Mexico, you're not going to be able to camp as part of your hunting. It means that in states like Montana, your motorized travel is going to be heavily restricted. Your camping, we just changed the law this legislative session. It used to be you could only camp for 2 days had to be 300 yards from the nearest access point. Now I think we can camp for 14 days, but again, heavily restricted. It means that if these lands that you probably hunt on, if you hunt in the West, are not going to have the same level of access that they used to have. So that's just access today. Then people are like, well, Randy, nobody has a crystal ball to know what's going to happen tomorrow. You don't know that these states are going to sell these lands. And you know what? You're right. I don't know with 100% certainty that these states are going to sell these lands. But I got a pretty good track record to look at in the rearview mirror. I have a lot of recorded statements from the people promoting these ideas of their past ideology of let's sell them, even though now they've kind of painted the turd a different color and call it something else, put a nice bow around it and called it state transfer. But there is a little bit of crystal ball here. And this is going to get into another part of what's creating a lot of the frustration of management of federal lands, and it's lawsuits. Okay. We have all kinds of federal laws that make anyone and everyone able to sell the federal or sue the federal government. And so nothing gets done. I know a lot of these foresters. My stepdad was a forester. I know lots of people who work for agencies who are highly trained biologists, you know, schooled in range management or forestry or whatever, and they aren't able to do their job because of all the lawsuits. So there's this premise that just because the land becomes state land, the lawsuits are going to go away. And history doesn't show that. I mean, here where I live in Bozeman, many of the drive-by litigators have offices right here on Main Street. Gotcha. I mean, the ones that are always litigating timber sales, grazing, blah, 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 any controlled burn, prescribed burn, even if it's done for wildlife habitat or whatever, it seems like if it's a management action, someone's going to complain.
Right.
And a lot of them go from not just complaints, but end up going to lawsuits and other things. So that creates a gridlock where the Forest Service and the BLM can hardly get anything done.
And that's one of the complaints that these folks have against,
exactly.
against federally managed.
Right. Federally so they say, because these are owned by the feds, that's the problem. Well, guess what? State lands are subject to these same federal laws. It's not like the Endangered Species Act. And here's how misinformed some of these legislators are. One of them tried to convince me that if the lands became state lands, the Endangered Species Act would not apply. Hmm. After I picked myself up off the floor in laughter, I said, "What did you say?" And he said, "Oh, the ESA does not apply to state lands." I said, "You might want to go and recheck that because it applies to federal lands, state lands, and even private lands." So all these lawsuits in the West that are about grizzly bears and wolves and spotted owls and wolverines and lynx and all, you know, maybe sage grouse pretty soon, all of these are under the Endangered Species Act, or most of them are. And if you think that these litigators are just going to fold up their tent and go away because now the lands are owned by the states instead of the feds, no. they aren't going away. They're going to keep litigating. They're going to keep suing. So this gets me to the crystal ball. Oregon has a really robust forest service, their forest system within their state trust lands. We all know Oregon as being a timber state. They manage those forests in a healthy way. They manage them, you know, they make good money on them for the states. Until you start creeping in endangered species issues. And Elliott National Forest in Oregon, I think it's 93,000 acres, was managed for quite a few years as a quite profitable forest. And then the litigation started and started and started and started. And it's been losing money and losing money and losing money. And like every other state, Oregon's state constitution says you and the state lands need to manage these lands for a profit, not to lose money. And the state lands people throw their hands up and say, "We can't stop these lawsuits. We're losing money. We can't do anything." Okay, what are we going to do then? Well, I guess we're going to sell them. 93,000 acres of Oregon's highest used recreation state forest is going to go to auction.
Wow, that's happening right now? Or that did happen?
That was in 2014.
Wow.
And the process started going through. The land board went and had all the hearings. Finally, there was such an uproar of the citizens of Oregon that either the legislature or the governor intervened and said, "Look, we got to find a better solution to this." But my point is that for these promoters of state ownership, to think that the lawsuits are going to go away and think that the states aren't going to have to sell lands when they can't make any money at them, when they become a huge liability for wildfires and weeds and road maintenance. These people can, they are smart enough where if you corner them on that issue, they're just going to change the topic. They know that the states will have to sell these lands,
right?
Which is exactly what their goal is. They don't want to come out and admit that, but these states cannot afford it. Anyone who's lived in a Western state knows that the Western states' legislatures are fiscally as conservative of any place you can be. So they're not going to allocate money for all the attributes that the BLM and Forest Service manage these lands for. Mm. So if you want to look at what the crystal ball will probably hold if the states end up with these lands and ends up with millions or tens or hundreds of millions of acres and they're in court all the time, go look at Elliott State Forest in Oregon.
And this is happening all across the West. It's not just Oregon where this is.
No, any place you have endangered species issues where the federal laws can be applied.
Okay.
You think about where we're sitting here in Bozeman, Montana, south of town. I mean, we got Gallatin National Forest here south of town. And prime grizzly bear habitat, wolverine, lynx, a lot of endangered species. And you go and look at what kind of protests happen every time they want to do a treatment for fire suppression or weeds or anything else to improve forest health. Mm-hmm. It ends up getting appealed, litigated, or something else. So if that forest, Gallatin National Forest, was a state forest, there's no way they could manage that profitably.
Right.
They would be in court nonstop.
Interesting.
You go, let's think about now this fall. I think we're going to find out if the sage grouse, the U.S. Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, is the agency that's in charge of determining what are endangered species. And it's been petitioned and studied and researched, and they've announced that they're going to determine if the sage grouse is an endangered species sometime later in 2015. Now, you think about if the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service data says we have to list them as an endangered species. Pretty much every place in the West that is a sage grouse or sage type environment is going to be subject to regulation, rules, and lawsuits under the Endangered Species Act, all in the name of sage grouse.
Gotcha.
So if you think that the states could go and manage those lands also, where now we've got a completely another species that the litigators can use as reason to tie up management actions. It's laughable to think that the states somehow aren't going to have the same headache that the feds have.
Right.
They just aren't.
So when this happened, the Sagebrush Rebellion, 25 years ago?
Yeah, 20,
something like that.
Yeah.
And you said that they got their asses handed to them,
right,
in the court system, correct?
In the court of public opinion more than anything.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And who led that, or how did that happen? And what's different? That's what's happening now. Is there a similar thing happening?
It's very similar. Okay. It was a classic find a crisis and let's leverage the crisis to accomplish our end goal. And back then, it was a similar crisis. It started with James Watt. He was the Secretary of Interior under Reagan. And, you know, I voted for Reagan, so I guess I'm guilty for James Watt being there. But anyhow, he came from this doctrine that we should sell the public lands. We should get rid of them because the federal government has no business owning these. We're not good at it, blah, blah, blah. And so that came, and he got fired for a multitude of issues. And the movement kind of died and drifted and had a few sparks here and there, but never really took up much interest until like 6 or 7 years ago. And then, you know, we had our lovely event, what was it, a year ago, when Cliven Bundy down in Nevada,
right,
he decided that he was going to graze his cattle on someone's land and never pay for it. Well, that someone's land happened to be ours. We as Americans. He said, I ain't paying for it. You know, talk about a welfare case of welfare cases. So he attracts and brings some more focus to the issue. And a lot of the chuckleheads are, oh, yeah, I'm going to go down there and bring my AR, and we're going to protect Cliven. I mean, you want to see low-information people. Check out those folks. And then they gave Cliven a microphone for a little while, and I don't know if you listened to some of his commentary, but, oh, And I it's stuff that I'm not even going to say on this podcast. But anyhow.
But that event helped spur this movement.
It just threw a little more fuel on the fire. I mean, it started in Utah. So a couple of years ago, the guy who you see on this ALC website, he's a representative down in Utah. He's in their legislature, either as a representative or a senator. I think he's a representative. His name is Ken Ivory. He's been the promoter of this. He's the president of this ALC, American Land Council. While he's in the legislature, he and some of his friends get a bill passed that says if by December 31st, 2014, so 5 months ago, 6 months ago, if the U.S. government does not transfer these lands to the state of Utah, we hereby appropriate $2 million to sue them, to turn them over to us. So that right now, Utah has appropriated $2 million, and they supposedly are going to go sue the federal government. The federal government's pretty much said go pound sand. So I feel bad for the good folks of Utah that their money's going to be wasted on what all the legal experts in Utah are like, why are we doing this? The fiction that's being cooked over here at ALC and on that website doesn't stand a chance. But we're going to throw away $2 million of Utah's money greasing somebody's back pocket here. I don't know.
How about even bigger than that? Like, what is the fear? What would be like the worst case scenario here, the actions that would be taken, like politically or by whatever means? What's the fear here? I mean, obviously the big fear is that they somehow do this, but I mean, is there a fear that they'll sneak it past people, or this will happen without people being aware? Or what are you afraid of?
I mean, well, here's kind of what's unfolded in the last 12 months. So ALC goes to all the Western legislatures. In any of you who have participated in politics of the Rocky Mountain states know that it's not that hard to gain some influence if you got a little bit of money and you got the right credentials. You can sucker people into just about anything. And so they went to all the Western legislatures, and there were bills presented in Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Utah, Nevada, Wyoming, Idaho, and Montana in the last 12 months in those state legislatures to force the federal government to sue the federal government to turn over all the BLM and Forest Service lands within those boundaries. And so you've got this fringe group of legislators who are pushing this idea. They got their asses handed to them. In Montana, I think we had 20-some bills related to that in our legislative session. Not a single bill passed. It was an absolute landslide against the notion. And if you, there's been a bunch of polling about it recently. In the only state where there's much support for it is in Utah, and I'm not sure why or what, but every other state the polling is that the citizens are completely against this idea. So they got thumped in Montana. They got thumped in Wyoming. I think in Wyoming they approved like $30,000 for a study to see if it was feasible. I think Colorado they got thumped. New Mexico they got thumped. And they got thumped by hunters. The people who are winning these battles in the legislatures and making a big mess on the streets are the hunters. And it's hunters of all political persuasion. I mean, it's not Republicans or Democrats or whatever. It's public land hunters who are like, over my dead body, you guys are not taking these lands from me. And to the point where in Montana, last summer in 2014, the Republican Party invited Ken Ivory up and some of the Montana legislators on the Republican side who are champions of this issue on the fringe, convinced the party to put disposal and transfer of public lands into their party platform. That we, the Republican Party, make it one of our ideas that we're going to get the federal government to transfer these lands to the state of Montana. Mm. And it's ironic enough that the same group of people 2 years ago in the prior legislative session said the state can't acquire any more lands because they don't know how to manage it. But oh, by the way, since Mr. Ivory has sold us on this idea, we're going to sue the federal government for another 30 million acres, even though we've been telling you guys the state can't handle any more land. So just that was kind of ironic. And it flew through, and they put their platform up on the internet, and all hell broke loose. And now guys are backpedaling, like, whose stupid idea was this? We just opened a can of whoop ass, and we can't get it back in the can. And so, and this isn't just specific to Montana. I'm using the example here because I'm so involved in it on a daily basis. But so they introduce these 20 bills,
right?
And they all get defeated. Every one of them. There are hunters up there just banging the table. I mean, if you could have been at the Capitol this year when we had the public land rally. They sent their little group of guys from Utah. They were looking for the doors before it was. They tried to hijack our event. And by the time we were done, those guys were scattering like rats off a sinking ship. And so you look across the West, same thing happened in all these other Western states. But this group has a lot of money. They're getting a lot of money from these dark money groups that kind of agree with them. And these are the normal big dark money groups you hear about in DC are funneling money out for this issue. So now, since about January of this year, they've taken the issue to Congress. So back to your question of Randy, where's the concern?
Yeah.
They have went to Congress and they've found some more fringe operators in Congress, some screwball wingnut morons who have said, yeah, that's a good idea. If we in Congress would pass a law that we gave you these lands, the courts can't say anything about it.
Gotcha. They're going overhead.
Right. They're going around the system. So yeah. If Congress, and I was back in D.C. in April testifying in front of a bunch of these guys who are promoting the idea, if you live in Idaho, Montana, well, not so much Montana. Our guys have pretty much said we want no part of it. But if you live in Idaho, Wyoming, some in Colorado, New Mexico, Nevada, especially Utah, you need to be asking your congressional people, where are you at on this? Because a huge number of them in those states are the ones promoting this idea. And the whole notion is, well, we'll just do it at the federal level. If the federal government decides we're going to dispose of our lands, that's way different than the states suing us to try get us to give them the land. Hmm. So that's the current concern is that Congress could be screwed up enough to do that. I mean, and
and who's fighting against that from happening
right now? And this gets to the problem that we as hunters suffer from is that we're not well organized on the national level. We're mostly local grassroots guys. We hate politics, so if we can avoid politics, we do. None of our advocacy groups are set up to really go and do that. We're all focused on conservation and access, and we're 501c3 groups that have restrictions on how much political activity we could do. These groups know that. So they're having a free-for-all in D.C. right now, trying to convince Congress to screw the American public out of their lands and give it to these state land agencies. So if you live anywhere in the United States, you have an interest in this discussion because you are an owner of these federal lands, whether it's BLM or Forest Service or whatever. And when they or if they get transferred to these state land departments, you who live in Florida and Texas and Minnesota and Illinois, you don't have say of anything.
Well, and it's wider than hunters too, because you think right. About Bozeman here, how many people are going mountain biking, hiking, camping, rafting, anything right. This weekend?
Right. As much as Bozeman's known to be a hardcore hunting hotspot,
yeah.
We're the minority of public land users here. Like you said, you know, hikers and campers and mountain bikers and picture takers and bird watchers and, you know, it's, but for whatever reason, they're silent on it. A lot of them are. And the people who are really putting up the big fight are
I guess is they're even less informed.
It might be.
I mean, I don't know that for sure, but I guess I feel that your average mountain biker is maybe less informed on public land use and management than your average hunter.
Yeah.
Possibly.
You're probably right. I don't know. The part that kind of cracks me up is I look at these groups and I say, all right, who else is opposed to this other than hunters? A lot of the chambers of commerce are opposed to it. The business owners. the Montana Timber Wood Products Association is opposed to it. If supposedly this is the cure for all of our forest problems, why is the Montana Wood Products Industry Association against this? Because they can see through it for what it is. You know, in the hunting world, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, and in full disclosure, I sit on the board of directors, they're against it. I mean, they've made some very loud public statements about how this is going to be a negative impact to access for their membership, to public land access, and how a lot of the conservation work that the Elk Foundation does is on these federal lands. The Forest Service and BLM are some of the biggest habitat and conservation partners. Mm-hmm. If these become state lands or private lands, who are you going to do this conservation work with? So
as a hunter or a general recreator, other than, you know, becoming even more informed, I guess, like, what are some steps that should be taken by people?
Yeah.
What would be your ideal situation to happen here?
My ideal situation would be is that these groups stick their neck out so far this time that we can just chop the head off the devil and put this to bed and just get over the idea that public lands supposedly are bad. Public lands in America, the whole notion that we have public lands is one of the leadership ideas of the world. People don't come from Japan or China or Europe or whatever to come to Montana or Colorado or you name it to go and see our shopping malls.
No.
They come here to see our public lands. Why? Because it's so unique to the world. Most places don't have what we have. So what can the average person do? First of all, I know we're all busy. Not everyone has the luxury Randy does that, hey, this is my life. This is what I live for. Most people are raising kids, working one or two jobs, just trying to make ends meet. And they don't have time. And that's, again, another thing the other side takes advantage of. But to the extent you can, don't necessarily believe what some politician tells you or some nonprofit group tells you. Do your own research. And think about it in the context of what's best for hunting and access. Not whether the person promoting it is an RRD or the person against it is an RRD. That doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. This is a hunting access American mom apple pie issue. Sort out what's best from your standpoint. And there are people who just are going to disagree with me. I get that. I understand that. But I don't think any of us benefit from just taking a spoon feeding from politicians and from quote unquote advocacy groups that when you roll back the covers on them, most of them are based in DC. Most of them are getting money from groups that you and I probably would say, well, that guy is probably not real interested in my concerns as a hunter. So, at the local level, if you can, your state legislators, make sure they know about the issue and make sure, if you just got to give them one word, it's I don't want to lose hunting access to my federal lands. It's just that simple. And if they say, oh, I'm in favor of protecting your hunting access to federal lands, say, good. I appreciate that. Thank you. And, oh, by the way, that means that you aren't going to give these lands to the state trust land trust departments who are then going to manage them just for a small constituency. I mean, I got nothing against schools. Don't get me wrong. I'd love to see all of our schools fully funded to a higher degree. But that's not what this is all about. State land departments do a good job. But this whole motion or this idea these people want is not about funding state schools.
Right.
It's about screwing us out of our public lands. I don't know, Dan. That's an awful long explanation.
No, do you feel like you've, are there any other lingering thoughts?
I'm going to take the headphones off and I'm going to say, oh gee, I wish I would have said this or I wish I would have said that. And I don't know how else to say it other than this issue, if it wasn't so damn important to the future of hunting, I would blow it off. I wouldn't be spending so much of my time going, you know, talking about it, writing about it, going to D.C., going to state legislatures. I hope people understand that it's that important.
Yeah.
It's the issue of my generation, and I'll be damned if I'm just going to sit pat and let politicians screw it over, because, like I said back when you asked me about why, this is what not just Randy Newberg's about. There's a million other stories of Randy, just like Randy Newberg, of people who, if it wasn't for public lands, they wouldn't be hunters. And I've been blessed to be given platforms and opportunity and have the support of my wife and financially be able to do this. And I don't give a shit who I piss off in the process. I don't care if I make any money at it. I don't care what. But when I go to my grave, these public lands are still going to be there for hunters.
All right.
It's that simple.
Is there going to be any info or anything on your website or anything that people can check out to get more info on this?
Yeah, you go to our forum, hunttalk.com. There are, and you just type in the search bar, you know, public lands or sale of public lands. If you Google it, most of the threads that come up will be from our Hunt Talk forum. So if you want to follow us and find out more about that, and on all of our platforms, I mean, we're launching and have launched our new website, randynewberg.com. And there you can find out about our TV show, Fresh Tracks. You can find out about the Hunt Talk podcast that we're doing right now, the Hunt Talk forum, which is the web forum. You can download our episodes. You can go to our YouTube channel. I mean, if it has to do with public lands, the odds are Randy and his big mouth are going to be there screaming and yelling, hopefully to the benefit of the hunters of America. But I don't know. It's just, you know, we're at this point in America where there's some things that should just be sacred, you know. You look at how hard families are working. You look at how tough it is to make ends meet. Damn it, if we can't at least provide them a place to hunt, then we've lost it. Then we've not done our job. And that's really gets to why this is important. I mean, and it's not just Randy Newberg who's screaming and yelling about this. There's a lot of other hunters out there, and I thank every one of them who are writing their elected people, they're making phone calls, sending emails. Every one of those make a difference. And I think if there's one good part about this, Dan, that I've watched from afar, I'm like, you know what? They've awakened the sleeping giant. The hunting community on this topic has started kicking asses and taking names, and people are like, oh my God, where did this come from? I had no idea. And it's really brought the hunting community to back to that point of activism again, where, hey.
But unorganized, though.
Somewhat, yeah. I mean, we're kind of like the guerrilla fighters, you know?
Well, what would it look like to have more organization? And could there be?
Yeah, I think there could be. You know, I own the domain name called The Public Land Hunter. I've never made it an official website or anything. And the reason I bought it and reserve that domain name is because of this topic when it really popped up on the radar 4 years ago, 5 years ago. And after I'd sorted it out and said, you know what, Randy, your initial impression, this could be a good idea. This is really a bad idea. What would that look like? That's interesting, Dan. I mean,
well, you talk about how all the different factions of the hunting public don't often get along.
Right.
And there's probably, you'll never get everybody on the same team. But
for sure.
I don't know. I think there could be a lot more just basic organization somehow. Oh, yeah.
There could be. And that's where, you know, herding cats is an overused expression. But I think with hunters, boy, does it apply. Because just by our general nature, we're loners. We don't want our buddy to know about our hot spot or our whatever. And so we kind of are just like a group of people drifting around, not wanting to be part of an organization. Part of why we go and hunt is to get away from all the structure of society, and organizations bring with it some level of structure that we got to be involved in. And so I don't know. If anyone out there listening wants to start the public land hunter advocacy group, I'd love to see them do it. I'm doing it to the best I can, and so are some other guys who have platforms. And some of our writers in big magazines have really stepped forward and denounced this as foolishness. I think what we're going to find is the courts are going to, if the Utah thing ever makes it to court, they're going to hand these guys their teeth. And then the remaining avenue is going to be, can they convince Congress to just give them the land? And if I'm living in one of the other states that don't have a lot of public land, and you say you're going to screw me out of those public lands, nah. I mean, you know, my wife sees me get so wound up about this. And she loved Charlton Heston. And so she'll always say, you know, cold dead hands, which means when he got up on the stage one time and raised a rifle and said, you can have these rifles or these firearms when you pry my cold dead hands from it. When it's a really important issue at my house, we say cold dead hands. at the Newberg house, this is the cold dead hands issue. And any politician who misjudged that, they've been on the beating end of my platforms. And those who have judged it properly have got nothing but accolades. And I don't really care what party they come from. I mean, that would be one of the dangers hunters could have here, is if we made this an issue of this party or that party. Because there's people on both sides who have sane positions on it, and there's people on both sides that have some crazy positions on public land. So it's just, you know, the hunter needs to look at his values, why these lands are important, and express that to the people who can make a difference. So that'll work, Dan.
That'll work.
We bored them to tears?
Well, they'll tell us, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, thanks for listening, folks. We sure appreciate it. And I think we could have got through this one, or did get through this one, as one podcast. And keep tuning in if you can. Please share these podcasts with your friends and others you think might have interest in it, because the more that it gets downloaded, the more powerful our message is.